Warning, this podcast has stories of real-life events and true crime that happens every day. These stories may contain adult language and graphic or disturbing details not suitable for everyone. Listener discretion is advised. In our society, most people are content to go through their daily lives safely and peacefully. But our society is not always safe or peaceful. For that reason, some men and women answer a higher calling to defend and protect their fellow man. You probably know someone who is one of these people, or maybe you are one of these people. The ones who see and do the things most people would never want to. These things are sometimes heroic and beautiful, but often they are horrific and terrifying. It's these things they don't share about with other people. It's these things they carry with them, so you don't have to. But when they get together, they talk to each other about them. And they call these stories war stories. Welcome to another episode of War Stories. I'm Tom.
I'm John.
And we're back with another guest via Skype. It's actually kind of easier to get people on Skype right now because of, you know, all the concern and stuff.
They're going to be home, at least.
We had, you guys know, Aaron, our nurse that we've had on, who used to be a firefighter, he was actually like, oh, you guys are willing to have me over in person? I said, well, yeah, why not? And he goes, oh, people know I work at an ER. They don't want me anywhere near my house.
Mm-mm-mm.
Like, man, people are freaked out, paranoid. But anything going on with you? Just been same old, right?
Same old. The lovely state of California, screwing us over.
That's right. But our guest that you have booked for this episode is Tim. Hey, Tim, how are you?
I'm doing well. Thanks for having me.
Oh, yeah. We're reading up on your backstory a little bit. I was like, hey, this is
I got to keep reading it because there's a lot of stuff on here.
You have a storied career.
It's definitely been interesting, that's for sure.
And you've done one of the things that I've always kind of wanted to do. I have no interest in getting my pilot's license if it was a fixed wing, but damn, I want to fly a helicopter.
Well, I've been very fortunate. You know, I've in the last 29 years, I've flown some of the greatest machines that the U.S. Army has produced. So I've been really lucky in that aspect.
Yeah, some of my funnest memories in law enforcement were, stabo, hanging below the helicopter doing stabo, and then, doing surveillance, coming up in the helicopter, taking telephoto lens photos of, you know, back before you could just use Google Earth to pull up an overhead image
something. I did one not too long ago, and I was like, hey, I hit up LAPD, and I was like, hey, I got to take pictures of a pad we're going to hit and blah, blah, blah. They're like, okay, do you have a camera you want to bring? And I'm like, no, but I thought the helicopter has cameras on it. I mean, I never really thought about it that way. She's like, well, just use your iPhone. I'm like, okay, but don't you guys have cameras? And she's like, well, we don't really kind of operate like that. You kind of just bring your own. So then I hit up another smaller agency that has the most amazing camera system actually mounted on the actual helicopter. So I guess every agency is different.
Yeah, well, it's kinda cool. We use CHP and we just opened the door and I hung out and the pilot said, you tell me higher, lower, slower, wider, whatever it is, and I'll do it. And I just hung outside open door with a telephoto lens, click, 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 click. And so one time I told him, I said, hey, can you fly over this? And he goes, sure. And so we fly over and I text my wife. I'm like, hey, come outside. And she goes, why? I'm like, just come outside. And then she comes outside and I texted her a picture of her on the porch from the helicopter. She goes, oh my God, is that you up there?
But you know, neither you or I were not pilots.
No. So Tim
is a pilot and
living the dream.
If you wouldn't mind giving us a little background on yourself, sir.
Well, in 1987, I graduated from college, became a second lieutenant in the Army Reserve. My degree was in criminal justice, and at the time, I got an ROTC scholarship, so they pinned me down to declare a major. So criminal justice, I thought, sounded pretty cool. So after graduation, I was actually commissioned as an ordnance officer, went to ordnance basic course, and then in 1989, I got a job actually 88, I'm sorry. I was hired with a small police department in central Iowa at the same time that I was in the Army Reserve. So I worked there for a while, and actually that's where I, one of the officers, a female officer, had gotten hired about a month before I did. And we were at our chief's house having a little party, and I met her husband, who was a pilot for the National Guard. And so I was talking to him, and he's like, "Oh, you know, you ought to apply. We're always looking for pilots." And so I called him up, and I think about 3 months later, I was at Fort Rucker, Alabama, starting the Army's pilot training.
Wow, and just like that.
Yeah, so I spent 13 years as a law enforcement officer in that small town for 7 years. And then after that, I moved to a town that was about 35,000 that is right next to where the airport is that we fly out of. So it made it a lot easier for me to do my flight training and stuff. I worked there for until 2001, and then I managed to get a job working full time for the National Guard, and I've been doing that ever since.
So now you fly full time for the National Guard?
I did up until a year ago, and I've been medically grounded now for a little bit, and I'm working through the medical disability process, but I did fly for all of the 28 years that I spent in the Iowa National Guard, yes.
Wow, so that wow. You really must have been able to fly just about everything that the military has to offer with regards to rotary wings.
Well, the way, you know, in the active Army, you go to flight school, you get assigned an aircraft, and then you spend the rest of your career, they move you around to different bases, but you fly the same aircraft. In the National Guard, you know, we are stationary, and we operate with the force structure that the Department of Army assigns to the National Guard. And about the time that I first started flying, we were a part of a cavalry squadron, and we had this was probably one of the only true combined arms organizations that the Army had, because we had. I was flying Cobras, and we had OH-58 observation helicopters, and then the ground troops had Abrams tanks and 113s and some heavy mortars. So we were pretty much a self-contained organization. But they started phasing out the Cobra, and the original plan was that we would be fielded with Apaches. So I volunteered to go to the Apache qualification course and then the instructor pilot course, which is a grand total of 20 weeks at Fort Rucker in Alabama. And shortly after I got back, the Army decided that they weren't going to. They changed the force structure again. So. We actually were going to start flying Blackhawks, but in the meantime, they couldn't field them to us immediately. So then I had to go to the OH-58 Alpha Charlie qualification course and the instructor pilot course. And then we flew those for a while waiting for the Blackhawks, and then had to go to the Blackhawk AQC, instructor pilot course. You know, the Army, I think, from what I understand, the Army is the only service that that requires you to do an instructor pilot course for each aircraft that you're flying. I think the other services all send you to a instructor course, and then once you graduate from that, you're able to instruct in whatever it is that you are qualified to fly. But the Army does a separate one for each aircraft, so I did four of those. The Cobra, the OH-58, the Apache, and the Blackhawk, and each one of those was 8 weeks, except for the Apache was 10. So I spent a lot of my life at the Western Army Army Aviation Training Site in Marana, Arizona, and at Fort Rucker, going through all of those courses.
Hey, Tim, I got a question in regards to you being a pilot and then in deployments. So I know when I was deployed, I felt like, you know, depending on the type of aircraft we had on missions and things like that, we would notice that we had different pilots quite a bit. And then again, I don't know anything about that world, but I would hear or find out that a lot of the pilots would get farmed out of National Guard units on certain rotations and then back home. Is that kind of how that worked, or?
Well, what a lot of people don't realize is that almost half of the Army's helicopters belong to the National Guard.
Right.
And so they designate these deployments by CAB, which is a Combat Aviation Brigade. And so, and then that CAB then is the higher headquarters, and then they fill in some of the pieces and parts. And a lot, every one of these CAB rotations, there is, you know, roughly half of this organization is made up of National Guard. Mm. So, you know, at that time, you know, prior to 2001, we actually had some of the highest highest experienced aviators in the country, because you know, when I first got in, I was flying with guys that had been in Vietnam, and you know, those guys could do some amazing things with helicopters.
Sure. Oh my gosh. Sure. Vietnam was like an era of pioneering. I mean, people don't realize how recent the helicopter is. It's one of the latecomers to the party, you know, airplanes and stuff like that, bombers, way before the helicopter. So Vietnam seems to be an era where the real pioneering of what a helicopter can do in active combat. I mean, it was really, really, those guys were writing the book, not reading it.
Yeah. It was all on the job training for them guys. You know, there was no school there to tell you how to do it.
Yeah. You go watch movies like We Were Soldiers, and you realize, you know, those pilots, man.
Wow.
Yeah. So.
Yeah, we had, you know, we had a lot of experience in the Guard. A lot of these guys that I flew with had, you know, 4,000 to 7,000, 8,000 hours. And the active arm, when I was in the Apache instructor pilot course, there was a kid that came to us from an active duty unit. He was the second most experienced guy in his unit, and he had about 700 hours, I think.
Wow. At the time. So that's a big difference.
Yeah. So,
I'm assuming that over your years, you've had probably multiple deployments, I'm assuming.
Well, I went to Iraq in 07, 08, which we could probably dedicate an entire episode to, because it was quite an experience. There was actually seven of us from the Iowa National Guard that went. We were assigned to a Air Force Expeditionary Training Squadron in Taji, and we flew with the Iraqi 12th Squadron, which was their training squadron. Mm. And the reason that we were picked to do it is because we had experience, a lot of expertise in the OH-58 Alpha Charlie. And
now for the listeners, that's the Bell Kiowa. Looks more familiar, because there is a civilian, like there's no civilian version of the Cobra or of the Apache, but there is a civilian version of the Kiowa. It's typical, you know, Bell helicopter, right? Is that?
Yeah. If you watched a movie in the 70s and 80s, every helicopter you see in there is a Bell Jet Ranger,
right?
Which is basically the same thing as an OH-58. There's some minor differences, but not much.
Right. Okay.
And so this Iraqi training squadron had three of these, and we were sent over there to fly with them and help train them. Wow.
That sounds scary.
Well, you know, these guys,
The only reason I say that is because I've seen what they do on the ground, and I don't know.
I don't know why to see what they do in the air.
Yeah.
In general, I agree with you. But, you know, these guys that I was flying with had been around for a long time, and most of them have actually been trained either in England or France.
Oh, interesting.
And they spoke, the older guys anyway, spoke pretty fluent English. And, you know, with one or two exceptions, they were actually really good pilots.
Oh, wow. Well, at least that's good to hear. Yeah, that's nice.
It seems like the pilot community, because it's so small, it's really easy to weed out the turds.
Sure.
It would seem that way.
Yeah. The thing with the, you know, it's a cultural problem with those guys. And that, and, you know, the guys I was flying with, we were flying with pretty regularly. And so, you know, it, the U.S. Army, we spend a lot of money to do what we call continuation training. You know, it's just the base pilot has to fly nearly 100 hours a year at a minimum.
Right, in service.
Just to meet the minimum, proficiency requirements. Whereas some of these other countries, you know, they have, we found with the Iraqis that a lot of times it was, you know, once they've been trained to do something, they're good for, they think they're good for life, you know.
So they don't culturally, they don't have the concept of perishable skills.
No, not really.
All right. That makes a lot of sense. Because then it's like we see with a lot of cops, it's on you to stay current. It's on you to stay up on the most recent training if your department's not going to send you. And when it's left up to the individual, most people won't go.
Yeah, no, you're right.
Most people won't go. So that makes a lot of sense. Well, the floor is yours, my friend Tim. What is your story? You can go back to Iraq if you'd like, or something else.
Well, you know, the reason that I contacted you guys, I discovered your podcast by listening to Dennis Miller, which seems to be pretty common. I mean, it was, I've listened to Dennis for a while, and I really enjoyed your talk with him. And so I started listening, and I even got my wife, I think, is a fan now, too. Mm-hmm. And the other day I was driving home from our headquarters, which is about a 2-hour drive, and I was listening to episode 12. And, you know, by the time I got done with that, you know, I was just crying like a little baby. And, you know, I haven't been in law enforcement for, you know, it's 19 years this month. And, I had thought that I had gotten through that 13 years unscathed emotionally, but you know, there's those things. We're all of us in this profession, whether it's military or police, are kind of tested in different ways, and everybody has their own different stories. You know, that you guys talk a lot about the feelings of being unworthy, and you know, for me, it's an honor to talk to you guys and some of the guys that you've talked with, because, you know, I've never had to fight for my life on the side of a mountain in Afghanistan, but, you know, we all have these experiences, I think, that, that kind of stick with you, I guess, for lack of a better term. And, you know, there's three things that, I've spent the last 19 years trying not to think about. The first one of those, as a law enforcement officer in the smaller town that I lived in, you know, I think one of the episodes I was listening to the other day, you were talking about how, you know, you don't shit where you eat. And, you know, in rural Iowa, everybody that worked on that department lived in that town, and everybody knew who we were.
Right.
And, you know, that's one of the
unavoidable.
That's one of the reasons why whenever we all did our drinking at somebody else's house, I never set foot in a bar unless I was on duty. Mm. And, but anyway, one night I remember getting a call. Oh, I guess I should say the other thing about living in these smaller towns is we don't have the option of, of waiting for the medical folks to get there first. We're always there before the ambulance shows up. And one day I get a medical call, and it's kind of funny because I can remember exactly what street I was driving on when I got the call. And there was some medical issue, so I start toward the address, and there was something in the back of my mind that just seemed like that sounded familiar. And when I pulled up in front of this house, it was my wife's best friend, and her and her kids had been at my house a lot of times. I didn't really know her husband that well. I knew who he was, but she's out there very distraught, and her husband had a heart attack. I was the first one there. Second one there, actually. When I got there, one of the neighbors was in their bedroom trying to do CPR on him while he was laying in bed, which doesn't really work very well. But, so I had to basically drag him off the bed, and me and this neighbor worked on him for a while. Thankfully, in that case, the ambulance didn't take too long to get there, but seems like an eternity when you're doing CPR. Yeah. And, there's just something about, we worked for as long as we could, and they took him to the hospital, but he didn't make it. And, the rational part of me is pretty sure that he was dead really before I even got there. And, I still, when I think about that, I get this, I don't know if it's survivor's guilt or whatever you want to call it, because she was a good friend of ours, and actually she still is. And, she had been at my house, and her children were over there. And, it's just that irrational feeling of guilt that you couldn't do something to help this person that you, so desperately wanted to help when they were when they really, really needed it. And I'm still friends with her and her children on Facebook, and every year they talk about their father and when he died that day. And
you were there for it, and one of the hardest things to feel in this profession is, we joke about it a lot. We joke about CPR. We joke about it because it's that part of that dark sense of humor. So. Yeah. People need to understand that, but
we're also human.
We're also human. Yeah. And when you get there and you really have a chance to survive, to help somebody survive or try to save somebody, you do put effort into it. You have to distance yourself emotionally after the fact, but you're there involved and just suppressing those emotions in the moment because you have a job to do.
Sure.
And when you we're so used to being able to control situations, you come up against something like that, can't control it, you just react to it, and it creates a feeling of powerlessness, and
oof, you get shook.
It's the best way to put it.
Yeah, absolutely.
And it doesn't matter how old you are, it doesn't matter how much time you have on.
Yeah. And I was gonna, you'd right before you had mentioned this story, you said that that you didn't fight on the side of a mountain in Afghanistan, but on the flip side, some of the more, I guess now, at least as far as I'm concerned in my career, doing or have done both, I think some of the more emotional times have been from things how you just described rather than an actual firefight. It's just totally different.
And there are guys that have probably been in those firefights that would then transition into law enforcement or firefighting or being a medic that were real tough and legitimately tough guys on the battlefield that would show up to something like that and realize it was their wife's best friend's husband and fall apart and, sure. and not be able to do it.
Sure.
So I think it's just, it depends on what level you get shaken at.
Yeah. And, and I commend you also for not really necessarily forgetting those feelings. Cause a lot of people, I guess, technically,
they deny them.
Yeah. They deny them. I think that's a good, that's a good word.
Yeah.
Deny.
Yeah.
You don't seem to be doing that, which is good. And
you try to suppress it and not think about it like all of the rest of us, but at least it's there.
Right. And it's okay not to forget. Yeah. There's a lot of stuff that happens at work. And I don't even know these people, but I don't forget.
Yeah.
Right.
You know?
Yeah. You know, it's just, we get into this profession because we want to make a difference. And, you know, and then, especially when it's somebody that we know. Sure. And,
well, you imagine. Know, when
you, I'm sorry. When you're not able to make a positive difference, you know, you almost, you feel, you know, that helplessness and you know, like I said, the rational part of me knows that there's probably nothing that I could do, but you get these irrational thoughts that, you know, you failed these people somehow.
Right.
And, you know, I guess how you deal with those irrational thoughts is kind of the key, I think, to your mental stability as you go through this.
Right. And that one of the things we always say is talking to people about it, because whether it's your car partner or your, you know, detective buddy at work or your guy that you served with or your wife, if you have that kind of relationship with her, or your best friend, just saying these things out loud, you could say, yeah, this is, I, you know, keep feeling like this, but I know that's stupid. And they, you know, oftentimes can go, you're right. It's stupid. You couldn't have done anything, but I understand why you feel that way. And just the reassurance that you're being stupid and the permission to understand that it's reasonable to feel that way is enough to kind of diffuse that temporary. It's like we need that to take the edge off so it doesn't, so we don't, our own thoughts don't swallow us
right,
up.
Right.
Because they will. You'll circle the toilet bowl. Yeah. In your case, you were saying, you know, in other instances, it's probably easier to tell yourself there was nothing I could do. It was over before I got there. But imagine in any circumstance where you're doing something for a friend or for somebody you have a personal relationship with, you always, it's human nature. If you care about that person or you have an emotional investment in that person, you want to do a good job. You really want to do your best, more so than any other time. And to then confront that in law enforcement where there is nothing you could do and you wish you could do more, it makes it even worse.
Sure.
It like doubles it.
You know, how many, what was the population in the city that you worked for?
It's about 9,000.
Okay.
Yeah. So that's small. And it's unavoidable. I mean, you probably only had a handful of people on your department. So
yeah, there was 13 or 14 of us. I think.
And I always tell people,
so much more of an investment.
Yeah.
Emotionally and physically, for sure.
Yeah.
And the fact of the matter is, to the small town, because I was technically a small town cop, even though I got loaned out to a larger state agency for a while. So when I was on patrol, it was a city of 36,000, mm-hmm. you know? And people used to always say, well, you know, oh, that's much less dangerous. And I go, well, depends on how you define it. I mean, I'm not rolling to gunshot after gunshot after gunshot. But the odds when there's less cops, right? You take LA PD, 10,000 cops, the odds of you as a patrol officer getting assigned to it are slimmer
right.
than an agency where there's only, you know, in your case, 14 people. So you have a 1 in 14 chance of responding to a gunshot or a murder or something horrific. And that if you're on patrol that shift, you have a 1 in 3 chance because, you know, only two other guys working. So the odds of you being the one selected to see some of this stuff go up, not down.
Right.
Yeah.
So.
Well, you know, the other two stories, I think, are really along similar lines. But now the second department that I worked for was about 34,000 people, similar to what Tom, what you experienced. It's kind of weird because it's in this, I'll call it a metropolitan area, but there's about 110,000 people. There's the largest city is 70 to 75 ish, and it's a real kind of a blue collar manufacturing town. The one that I worked for was about 35 ish, has one of the three state universities, and it's a very college, kind of a white collar college town, and the dichotomy is amazing because, you know, by 2 o'clock in the morning over on our side of the city limits, it was getting pretty dull. on the other side, they were just getting going, you know, we'd listen to them running around all night with gunshots and all kinds of other things. But for some reason, this one day I was working a day shift, which I avoided for most of my career, just because
I think real
for reasons you guys all understand.
Yeah. There's the admin's not around. You're not taking BS Autoberg calls.
I could tell you we could do a whole other podcast on the people that were running our department. But so it seemed to me that it was 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. I get another call of medical and I don't remember how it came in, either a medical or some kind of a disturbance, but I pulled up in front of this house, and there's a woman standing in the driveway, and she's naked, and something looked weird about her, even over and above the fact that she was in her driveway naked at 10, 11 o'clock in the morning. And as soon as I got out of my car, I was hit with the smell of burning flesh and human hair.
Oof.
And if you've ever, you know, I'm kind of smelling it right now, just talking about it.
Yeah.
And
we've talked about that. You can't describe it, nor can you forget it.
You can't unsmell it. And it's about as nasty as it. And it turns out this woman had some very severe mental problems, and her husband had gotten in an argument, and she went out into the garage, poured some gasoline on herself, and started herself on fire. And what I saw when I was pulling up was basically the last of the gasoline burning off of her as she's standing out in the driveway. And, you know, she was obviously, you know, very mentally disturbed. And so I'm trying to talk to her, calm her down. And she wouldn't let me anywhere near her. And she started to run off. And I started after her. And then I'm thinking, you know, what the hell am I going to do if I catch her? Because here's this horribly burned, naked woman and that doesn't want me anywhere near her. So, you know, it turns out luckily again, this time the ambulance showed up very quickly and we were collectively able to calm her down and they took her off to the hospital. But I found out a couple days later that she didn't make it, but she had been burned pretty bad, not only, but I think it was her lungs that,
she seared her lungs.
In that part, breathing that stuff in is what really does damage to you. But when she ran off and I'm standing in the driveway all by myself waiting for the ambulance to show up, that's a helpless feeling right there.
Sure.
Well, I could not think of one single thing that I could do to make the situation better.
I mean, and pretty much there literally wasn't.
Yeah.
You know, aside from the smell, how soon did you realize what actually had happened or what was going on?
As soon as I got out of the car and I smelled that smell, and I kind of took a close look at her for the first time, and I could tell that she had been, you could see the burns on her face, and they were probably just
starting to appear too.
Yeah, they were, and it seems, maybe I'm just making shit up, but it almost seems like her, you know, there was still kind of some smoke coming off her hair, and, you know.
There probably was.
It was still smoldering.
The thing that people don't realize, you know, in a situation like that is that, you know, your brain, you know, no matter who you are, it's not programmed to see things like that.
Nor is it ready for it.
Yeah. So when it happens, you're trying to rationalize it, whether you're doing it consciously or you know, or in the back of your mind. So you're going to get that.
What am I looking at?
Was that real?
Okay. There's no way that's looks real. Like this, and there's no way it's that.
Right.
And then it turns out it's exactly that.
Right. Yeah.
There's that, and there's a delay that's caused by that. There's a whole second guessing of yourself that's caused by that.
So you're not making up. I mean, I'm sure 100% that's what you saw. It's just a matter of your brain trying to make it real.
Right. Your brain goes, I swear I saw that, but that can't have happened. No, it actually really can. That's a perfect example of my point. You can talk to a lot of big city cops, and I guarantee you my father spent 25 years at LAPD, saw some weird stuff. He probably saw some stuff that you, Tim, never seen. But I also know he never had to roll up on a woman who had poured gasoline on herself and lit herself on fire. It's not about where you work. People are the same. We've discussed this. Shitheads are shitheads, right? Yep. Dirtbags are dirtbags, no matter where you go. Well, it's the same thing with regular people. They're going to have regular people problems, and they're going to do messed up, insane things. And there's really nothing that's going to change, whether it's the size of your department. Yeah, you may, you know, get fewer calls in a shift, but when you get a doozy, it's your number.
Like the smaller departments, when it happens, I mean, it goes off. Like,
yeah,
that's it.
Yeah, I could tell you we had one happen on Christmas that I'll tell the story someday, because it was one of those, you know, we've been telling people this is a problem for 2 years, and then finally it ends up in homicide.
You know, you would think that would be the most fucked up thing that happened to me, but it's actually not, because.
So you're a shit magnet.
Well, no, but I hung around with a lot of them, I think. So the first month that I was hired with this department, the second one that I worked for, every year they had a program they put on that's called Safety City. And the irony of that, we'll get you here in a minute, but what they do is they have they bring all the kindergarten students to this big parking lot, and they have police and fire and ambulance and all kinds of other folks there, and they teach them how to cross the street, and you know, the police officers are your friend and all that usual stuff that you talk with 5-year-old kids of. And at some point in this, because I was one of the latest, the people that were most recently hired had to go do this.
Low man on the totem pole.
Yeah.
Yeah. You got tagged for it because you're the new guy. And so, in the middle of this, I'm standing at the back of an ambulance. You're looking at the back of the ambulance. I'm standing on the right side of the door opening. The right door was open, you know, 180 degrees. So it was off. What? The opposite door was only open about 90 degrees. So it was kind of sticking out from the back of the ambulance. We had a group of kids there, and the paramedic was talking with them, and I heard a, I don't know if you ever been around golf carts, there's a clunk that they make when you push the accelerator that releases the parking brake.
Right.
Very, very distinct sound. And I heard that sound, and I looked back, and off to my right, there was a golf cart that my supervisor used to run around and tell us what to do, so we didn't have to walk the whole time. But when I look back, there was probably, I seem to remember about 5 or 6 kids that were kind of on or around this thing. And I heard that, you know, when young kids get surprised, you know, they kind of these gasps and screaming, and somebody had pushed the accelerator of this golf cart, and it came straight at the back of this ambulance. And there was a 5-year-old boy named Derek that was he ended up, his head was crushed between the front of that golf cart and the 90 degrees corner of the ambulance. And, you know, then after that, it was just mass chaos. And, you know, I honestly, I don't remember a single thing that happened after that other than helping the paramedic pack this kid up and get him into the ambulance so they could get him to the hospital. And I get, you know, really the only other thing I remember about this incident is having to answer the questions of the attorneys for the fucking lawsuit that happened after that.
Right. Mm.
What? So the golf cart, were the kids playing on it?
They apparently had been playing on it. Oh, yes.
Got it. Okay.
And
the key was still in it, and somebody pushed the accelerator, and for whatever reason, it just came right towards us in the back of the ambulance.
Now, what? So you were talking about, you know, putting the stuff behind you and spending time not thinking about it and just, you know, putting it away. And yet we treat ourselves like crap if we start to feel emotional about some of the crap we've seen, right? We always, oh, you're just being a baby, or you're, you know, you can handle it, you know, all that other stuff we tell ourselves, or that, you know, we've been told suck it up kind of thing. And in that instance, you've got three stories, right? And each one of those stories in anyone else's life would be the worst day, their worst memory, the worst thing they've ever seen, just by virtue of the fact that they were there and witnessed it happen. Mm. If you witness somebody who had just set themselves on fire, and just that sight alone is enough to stick with you and scar a normal person, let alone seeing what happened to this young boy, or being present trying to do CPR on your wife's best friend's husband. You know, any one of those three would be a contender for the worst memory in anyone's life. And you got three of them, right? And you get those three. And I'm sure if we spent time, you could come up with some other things that would also be contenders for the worst memory of another person's life. So the intro to the show, you know, mentions that we see these things so you don't have to. And it's really because you don't want to. You shouldn't have to. It's terrible. Mm-hmm. But we also, as, you know, first responders, we got to make sure we give ourselves the same permission to be human as, you know, once it's done, and recognize that was probably, for other people, the worst thing they've ever seen. And for me, it was Tuesday.
Right.
Yeah. You know, it's one of those things you wouldn't wish it on anybody. And, I don't know. That's one of the reasons we justify not talking to, you know, my wife is the sweetest, kindest person you'll ever meet. And, you know, it's bad enough I got to drag this shit around with me. I certainly wouldn't want her to have to, you know, have to carry that kind of a burden around with them. And, you know, I, to an extent, you're trying to protect them from it, but, you know, just as a practical matter, it's like, you know, just because I have to, it seems you don't want to burden somebody else with having to carry that stuff around. Cause,
and that's why when we find each other and we realize somebody says, oh, and there's code phrases that we have to ask when you start to get the hint because of language or words that somebody's using that they might be involved in law enforcement or firefighting or whatever, there's code phrases that we can throw out there to, you know, figure it out. And then when you find that person, you have an instant connection, the same way two Marines who find each other would have an instant connection, because you both have a set of shared experiences that are so fundamentally life transforming that you guys instantly share a common bond and some common ground that, A, if you haven't done it, you won't truly understand it, and B, is something you don't really want to share with people who don't have to deal with it. That's, oh, I know you've had to see this. Well, so have I. So therefore, we can talk and not pollute everybody else.
Sure.
Yeah, and that's, I think that's what really motivated me to email you guys in the first place, because you're, you know, all the other episodes, and, you know, it's been therapeutic for me, I think, just listening to your podcast and hearing about all the other shit that that people have had to go through, and you know,
I'm not alone and I'm not crazy.
Right.
Yeah, and I'm, you know, I'm in the point where I'm going to be retiring soon, and I'm moderately healthy, and my wife hasn't left me, even though she probably should have a long time ago. And you know, in one of your episodes, you talked about finding that one thing in retirement, and I will tell you, if for me, that's been grandchildren. I have a 13-year-old, one that will be five, and one that's will be four. And you know, I told my kids the only good thing about having children is eventually you get to have grandchildren.
Right.
So, you know, I'd highly recommend it. If you don't have kids now, start working on it so that you can enjoy your grandkids when you get old, because they definitely keep you young.
Yeah, I, my wife and I, and then another cop friend of mine, we were both, you know, going through the process same time. We're both about the same age. We both had our kids the same year. Like, he has a son, I have a daughter that are the same age. He has a daughter, I have a son that are the same age. And we did it way earlier than any of our other friends. Mm. So now we are in our 40s and our kids are in college or getting out of high school. And so we're looking for, you know, he's got 10 years before he has to retire or can retire. So he, you know, he's not like this guy that says, oh, I can't retire. I should retire, but I have to stay another 3 or 4 more years because I've got kids that are still in college. This is like, no, I can't retire for another 6 years, and I'm already done paying for college. Yeah,
right. Yeah.
So get in on the ground floor of kids, folks. It pays off in the end.
I had three kids right at about the time I was getting started, and you know, I said, fortunately, my wife stuck with me this whole time, and now I'm enjoying the fruits of that.
As you should, because you deserve it.
And we want to do a wives episode. We've got, I think, some wives that are lined up. My wife is willing to do it. I know your wife is willing to do it. Mm-hmm. We've got another, working on Aaron's wife. She's an elementary school teacher, so I think it's still pretty rough for her.
Yeah, that'd be interesting.
But, you know, and we had Jim, my old chief, on, and he mm-hmm. was talking about his gun store mm-hmm. during the coronavirus. And, he used to say that we wear the badge, but the wives carry it, right? And if you've got a wife, the reason I bring that up is because Misty, this gal, she told me once, she says, you know, the thing that helped me stay through all the hard stuff was that I knew the man Aaron was before all this happened, mm-hmm. and I just needed to get him to get that guy back, you know. So if you think about it, if you marry a woman who doesn't know you beforehand, stand by, because she may think that's all there is to right. you is a freaking asshole.
Oh, Danielle, which is my wife. You know, you had mentioned. I know in the email, and you had also mentioned on the show that your wife had started listening to our show. If you're okay to talk about it just briefly, I mean, has she brought up anything that she might have, I don't want to say learned, because I'm sure she's learned so much from you over the past few years, but anything that has come up between you two since listening? Or maybe you've opened up a little more. You tell me.
Yeah, she's going to be, I think when she hears this, I think she'll be surprised, because I've never talked to her about this kind of thing. She mm. knows. She knows a lot of the funny shit that.
Sure.
There's all kinds of, you know, that's, you could fill several podcasts with all the funny shit that happened, but I think she just, she hasn't really talked about it, but she, you know, we'll be listening to it and we'll get somewhere and we'll have to sit in the driveway and wait to finish the rest of the story. Cause she's really getting into it. And I think it's brought us a lot closer just by her hearing these other types of stories. Cause, you know, I don't talk to her about these, you know, those things. Like I say, you don't want to, I don't know. Maybe you're just being selfish.
No, you know what? I think there's an element of being able to listen to it with your spouse, and somebody says something on the show about their experience or about how they felt about it, and you identify with it, and you can point to your spouse and point to what they just said and say, without getting into it, that. Mm-hmm. I have felt exactly that. And they can go, really? Like, I never, you know, and you can safely kind of point to things that are feelings you've had or thoughts you've had or experiences you've had without getting into specifics necessarily, that it's just a shorthand of, I have never talked about it, but yes, that's exactly me.
Right.
Yeah, I agree. And I don't know how to even describe it, but I think just from us listening together and her taking such an interest in it really has, you know, I think it's brought us a lot closer together. And, you know, if it wasn't for her, I would have self-destructed a long time ago. But
same with me. You know,
shout out to all the wives all out the wives. There dealing with our bullshit.
And husbands for the...
Yeah, true.
So that, Well, is there, you know, we dedicate our episodes to our fallen brothers and sisters, but we always let our guests have first crack at it.
Yeah. On the 2nd of November in 2003, a CH-47 was shot down near Fallujah by an SA-7, and the crew was DW-4 Bruce Smith, Sergeant Paul Fisher of the Iowa National Guard, and Lieutenant Brian Slavens of the Illinois National Guard. Those three were killed, and 13 of the 26 passengers that they were carrying, and they were on their way to Baghdad to take them to their to go on leave. And 13 of those people in the back were also killed. Yeah.
It's always to go somewhere to go home,
right?
Yeah.
So, well, rest easy, brothers. We got it from here. And Tim, I appreciate you emailing us, and you know, for all those of you out there who think, because mm-hmm. we've gotten people that have said, I love the show, and I'm a cop or this, or I'm a firefighter that, or I'm a vet this, and say, well, you know, if you want to come on and share your story, let John know. And I will tell you, it's surprising how many times that I get. I'm not surprised by the amount of people that go, I don't know if I can do that. I don't, you know,
right.
they're afraid or hesitant because it's not their thing, whatever. But the amount of people that say, I'd love to, but I'm not a hero like you guys, or I don't have those crazy stories like you guys. It's not about that. It's not about that.
Here's the thing. You can have 20 years doing something that we talk about, or you can have a week. And guess what? You've seen something that most people haven't.
Yeah. So. We had a young kid that I've talked about on the show, and I went on in the first 3 months during FTO, he performed he was 21 years old, and he had to perform CPR on a 3 year old, a 3 month old, and a 3 day old first 6 months of all on FTO. And if you think for 1 second that the average 21 year old has done that in a 6 month span, you're insane.
Right.
So it's not that was 6 months on the job, and that just happened to him. You know,
yeah, that's crazy.
And you know, just real briefly, you had mentioned command staff, and this is going to be a whole nother episode, but command staff. Were you talking about the rural town that you worked in, or were you talking about the bigger agency?
In the smaller town that I worked in, you know, the chiefs that we had, you know, we were a small group. And so I think we all got along pretty well. It was
some. He probably had a working chief, right? He probably had to.
Pretty much. Yeah. And, you know, little towns is there's a lot of politics that goes on there.
Yeah, so the reason I had brought that up, if you're okay with it at some point, if you're okay to talk about it, we'll have you back on. And we're trying to, something that we're going to talk about is putting together an episode where we talk about just that, like command staffs. But I want to have it from all around the country, right, not just in the state of California, because it's an issue everywhere and not just here.
Right.
So
the larger department that I worked with was just, and you know, my timing apparently really sucked, because they brought in a new guy from the East Coast, and he was trying to turn us all into public safety officers. Mm. So we were going to be firefighters and police officers.
Oh, yeah, it's just a mess. And there's so many people. And
I personally don't think that's a good idea, but yeah. The way this guy went about it, and you know, he promoted a few people that had a real lasting effect on that department. And by 2001, when I was able to start working with the National Guard, I was so fucking glad to get out of there. I couldn't leave fast enough. And I tell you, I haven't missed it. Other than the people that I worked with,
right. Sure,
I haven't missed it for one fucking day.
I miss working the road with my cops, my partners. I don't miss the bullshit.
Yeah.
At all.
So, I mean, so at a later date, if you're willing to come on and speak from it on your end, we'd love to have you.
Oh, yeah. I'd be happy to. And like I said, if you want to talk about Taji, that was quite an experience. Sure. Also.
Yeah, that's true.
Yeah.
Whenever, I'd be more than happy to come back. You know, I appreciate what you guys do. And I think, you know, everybody has a podcast now, but I think this finally gives you kind of a national forum where anybody can, you know, yeah, guys like me don't have to go find a local support group. You know, you can just sit and you can listen to stories from people all over the place. And so you
guys support groups are for pussies. And I can't shake that feeling. I really can't. Like, this is basically a podcast support group. Like, fuck, I know you. Theoretically that's kind of what we're doing, yeah, in a weird, yeah, sideways way. But
yeah. Yeah.
Anyway, well, Tim, I appreciate it. Yeah, stay in touch with John, and we'll get you back on for our admin episode, hopefully, because you've got some small town experience that would bring an interesting perspective, as opposed to working for a large, you know, paramilitary faceless organization like the Los Angeles Police Department. And we definitely want to hear about your time in Iraq.
Yeah,
so.
And Taji. Yeah.
Oh, that'd be great. I'm happy to come on anytime.
Thanks, Tim.
Okay, all thanks. Right. Reach out. You have my number, okay?
All right, thanks, all right, guys.
Sir.
Cool. Oh, that's cool.
Yeah, he's a nice guy.
Yeah, he is. It's been interesting, and he. I want to make sure we reach out to Tim, and we'll send him a T-shirt when they're finally back in stock. I think we have a... it's going to be about 3 weeks, I think, and then we'll have some stuff back in stock.
Oh, you mean we might reopen this fucking state?
Yeah.
Oh, disgusting. Yeah,
well, we are at a soft open, right?
Yeah, I guess we're at a soft open. I mean, we were at a soft opening before they even announced a soft opening. Oh my God, so.
Yeah, so, and I know our podcasts are evergreen because you can listen to it at any time, but the ones during the Rona, people will be able to tell because we're so frustrated.
Oh my gosh.
Shit is shut down. But I wanted to, before we finish, I wanted to share a couple of follow-ups because, you know, in this instance, we had Tim, you know, get in touch with us because we're just pretty open like that. Mm-hmm. I mean, if you get in touch with us and talk to us, we'll absolutely hear your story, because it's not about us going, we want the best, most gory, most bitchin'-rific, you know, train killer, high speed, low drag.
Right.
No, that's not.
We just want you to tell your
story. We want you to tell your story, regardless of what that is. So that's, you know, when Tim kind of came to us, or more recently when, or prior, JR had turned somebody on to us, and we just released an episode where he was talking about his uncle, mm-hmm, or his great-great-great-uncle, and doing the research into that. So as a consequence of that, we had mentioned on the show that if he was ever ready to get a headstone for this unmarked police officer's unmarked grave, we'd be willing to, you know, put out a GoFundMe or put into this or put into that. We get an email from, I'll just say Fred, and he says, I'm a fan of the podcast and I run the GAR Cemetery for Miami, Oklahoma, which is Grand Army of the Republic. The boys that fought for the North in Civil War. I'm hoping to help with getting a headstone for the officer in the episode by passing along some contact information. And then he gives me some contact information for a guy and says he's the president of the ICCFA, International Cemetery Cremation and Funeral Association. And he will, they will be holding their school something in July in Atlanta, right? So he's giving information on this association actually being in Atlanta.
Sure.
Where is the area where this all occurred and where this unmarked grave is.
I didn't know any of this, by the way, people.
They would likely donate a memorial stone if you just asked.
Wow.
So he's got a couple other links that he mentions in there as far as if that doesn't work out. But it's those kinds of things right there. Like, I just got that email and I went, that's bitching.
Yeah, that's awesome. That's amazing.
And it doesn't happen if he doesn't mention this unmarked, you know, grave.
Sure.
And us reaching out and just saying, hey, you know, or you know, Tim listening to episode 12 with Mike.
Yeah, the community is so much bigger than just where you work.
Right. And which also goes back to, I'm not crazy and I'm not alone.
Right.
But the other ones that came in, and I wanted to make sure I share them with you. So it says, real quick, we're going to answer this one. It's from Brooke in a little more in depth when we can get some people here that are experts on it. But this was the question. I want to let you guys know, I listened to the past couple of days. I love them. Keeps me going through these tough times. I always dreamed of going into the Marines. Some other issues during MEPS, I wasn't able to. Listening to these podcasts kept me motivated and chasing after firefighting and paramedic work. She's not a veteran, but she appreciates everything we do and wants to ask if we have any advice on starting a career in firefighting or an EMT. I could tell you the generic advice from us, and then we will get some, we'll get James and Aaron and Pete and some of our other ambulance and firefighter friends on. But from a public safety perspective is get yourself in physical shape, right? And really start to do the research. You can, if you want to be a firefighter, go to college, take some fire science classes, because getting to be a firefighter is going to take probably three times longer at a minimum,
especially depending on where you're trying to get hired.
From what I know, the path should be start as an EMT or a paramedic on an ambulance and then look for fire departments that have volunteer firefighters. So then you become a volunteer firefighter, you pass their qualifications, they give you gear. You can show up, you develop a reputation, you put some experience. When you go in front of a fire department's oral board, and apparently, if you're talking LAFD, what did we find out? It was like 30,000 people go and apply for
something dumb.
Three firefighter jobs or whatever the hell it is. So when they're going through these applications, they can literally cut half of them out by saying, not qualified. Then they look at the ones that are qualified. Oh, they have some college with fire science. Oh, they have worked on an ambulance. Oh, they're a volunteer firefighter.
Right.
All those things start to...
Yeah, they start to build up. They start to add up.
Yeah.
And I, you know, the advice that I've given pretty much anyone that's asked me, whether it's law enforcement, fire, whatever, it really doesn't even have to be public safety. What is going to make you stand out more than anybody else? And you also have to remember going into it, there are going to be people that have more experience. There's going to be people that have better qualifications, but what makes you stand out more than them? And if you look at it from that standpoint, I think you can kind of find the path to prepare yourself more for what you're about to get into.
Right. And then we had a question that was, hey guys, I'm in lockdown over in the great country of Belgium.
The fuck?
And well, you know, they have really good waffles.
I have a Belgian Malinois.
They have great Malinois and they have great waffles.
I got one.
But they speak French.
But they speak French.
Yeah, which is, active duty Army and just hit a 6-year mark. He ETSs May of next year. Looking into transition to law enforcement, something he's always wanted to do since he was a kid. And it took him, the military took him a different route. So now he's ready to kind of move on from the military and go pursuing the law enforcement career. So 6 years, I would guess probably he's probably 24, 25-ish, which is good age to get out of the military and get into law enforcement.
Yeah.
He initially wanted to go to, I think it says 10, so I think it's Tennessee, but it's ranked as one of the worst states to be a cop. If we have any Tennessee coppers,
yeah,
let us know that you can fill this gentleman in on whether Tennessee's a worthwhile place to pursue a career in law enforcement. Because, I mean, you got Nashville, you got Memphis, you got some great areas.
Big cities.
So, yeah, it might, I don't know. But it's, he says it's possibly ranked one of the worst states to be a cop. Having an issue finding a balance between pay and location. Any tips on narrowing the search? The biggest draw to me is law enforcement's a different every day and presents new opportunities, situations, and problems. But he's not looking for a boring small town, but he's also not really looking for NYPD or anything in California. You can find a good balance.
Yeah.
There are some boutique agencies, as I like to call them, that are in rich areas.
They have them just because they have to have them.
And they get paid a lot.
Yeah.
For example, I went to training with some guys from Menlo Park. Mm. Menlo Park is a very wealthy area up in the Bay Area. And their police officers get paid a lot. And because it's a wealthy area, there's not a ton of crime to respond to. However, Menlo Park shares a border with East Palo Alto, an EPA, as they like to call it. And so the Menlo Park guys just jump over the border and help out the East Palo Alto guys when they need it. And the East Palo Alto guys, you know, unfortunately get paid half to do twice as much work. So which one's smarter? I don't know.
Yeah. I mean, I guess it's really what you want to do. I mean, you want to work a busy area. You want to get paid a lot. You want to find somebody in the middle. I mean, you could pretty much go anywhere.
Yeah. Figure out what you want to do. Yeah. If you're a rural guy and you like, you know,
But don't do opposites. Like, don't be like, I want to be a street cop and then go to Beverly Hills.
Yeah.
Or I want to get paid a lot and then go to LAPD. Like, that, it's not going to happen.
If you just want to be in law enforcement,
right,
then do that.
Right.
Right. That's the advice I gave people, which is if you're just want to get into law enforcement, then the bottom line is get your foot in the door. In other words, right, get hired on to a department.
Right.
Get a badge, get sworn in, and then from there, prove yourself. Have a good, you know, if within 18 months, right, by the time you have your post certificate, you'll have set a reputation for yourself. If you're going to do it, set yourself a good reputation, mm-hmm, or a bad reputation. If you're going to set that, you can also have a, you know, nothing reputation where it's like, oh, he's fine. But even that, the training, the fact that you have had time on the job, that's going to help you when you're going in front of these oral boards where, you know, you're talking about, they're looking at, you know, five guys that have no experience and have never been to the academy, and then two guys that have at least a year on the job and have already been to an academy.
Right.
So you're going to narrow that down to two guys. And if there's two spots, guess what?
Probably one
of them. Then it's going to come down to the background.
Right.
So yeah, you're just by having some experience and having a good reputation and having a job in law enforcement, it's like anything.
Wait, this question came from where again?
Well, he's in Belgium.
He's in Belgium. Okay.
But he's going to ETS.
Got
and
it.
Wanted to go to originally Tennessee, but he's worried. So, like I said, I can't speak to Tennessee specifically. So, if we have any Tennessee people, you can email us and we'll inform this gentleman on what you think of it. But other than that, I mean, figure out what you want to do in law enforcement. If you're going to be that specific, for example, we had John's buddy who went federal.
Mm-hmm.
Right, and he did federal law enforcement, and now
he was a sheriff. He was a county sheriff, and then went federal. Sheriff,
then went federal, and then went
back to a small city.
Went back to a small agency. No. So he, I think it would actually have been small agency, then federal, then
county. Then county. Right? Yeah, then county.
I think that's what it is.
Yeah,
but regardless, he tried different things, and now he's doing what is the best fit for his lifestyle, his needs, his goals, his family, you know, because that's what it's all about. So if you want to go be a hard charger and get a bunch of notches on your belt for Donnybrooks and and responses to shootings and stuff like that, then go to a big city and then volunteer to go to the worst area of town.
That has decent policies still.
I mean, even then, right?
Well, that's a whole nother
story.
That's
a whole other story. There's people that do police work and there's people that follow the rules of
that the administration. That like to put on the uniform.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. I told you, I used to call my sergeant a base coach. I say, you're on the field and you're in the uniform, mm-hmm. but you're not actually playing baseball.
Cosmetic cop.
So, well, that's a day shift, night shift conversation too, because you will, when you get the new influx of people at your department that you've never worked with before, they're young, they're fresh out of the academy, fresh out of FTO. Watch who put, when the shift rotation comes open, watch what people put in for, mm-hmm. and that will tell you a lot about who you're dealing with.
Yep.
All without fail for me, all the people that I have initially seen try to get on day shift, they all want to get promoted, kiss the chief's ass. They want to be around the station. And then all the guys that are like, I don't care if you promote me, I want to go kick some ass. They all put in for graveyard shift the first time shift rotation mm-hmm. comes out, because they know that's where the action
yep.
is. So it is what it is, you know. But those were our emails that I thought were worth sharing, because those were
keep
both
sending emails.
Cool. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Keep trying to, we'll answer them every single time we have a podcast.
And it's helpful. I tend to ask people, do you want your answer? Do you want us to discuss it, or do you just want me to tell you right now?
Right.
So if you want to tell us, hey, if you know, I don't want this read on the podcast, if we'll you know,
we'll just get back to you.
There have been circumstances where we could tell this was we're not talking about it on the podcast, and we respond privately. Most recently, John and I were texting back and forth, you know, as we had a conversation with one of our listeners, that was not for the podcast. It was just for the three of us. And, we're glad that that went the way it did.
Right.
But for those of you that, you know, want us to read it or want us to discuss it, tell us, we'd be more than happy. Or if we don't know, like the firefighting EMT thing, we're going to get
firefighter EMT.
We're going to ask them. So do you have anything?
No. Just remember, if you guys need help with anything, please reach out to us. If you need more help than we can provide, we will link you up with people that can do that.
Yeah, yeah. And these episodes sometimes are tougher ones to hear. I know, you know, it's funny, he was talking about, you don't want to share that stuff. And as soon as he started talking about some of those stories, especially with the little boy, I was like, oh man, people, you know, people mm-hmm. This is going to hit people right in the pit of their stomach. Right. And I almost felt bad that, you know, there was going to be people out there that were going to have to listen to that, that had never dealt with that in their careers. But that's what this show's about.
Mm-hmm.
So, if, you know, that bothers you, I mean, good. It's better that it bothers you than it doesn't. And sure. if it doesn't bother you, maybe figure out why.
Yeah. So.
All right. Well, until our next episode, come home with your shield or on it.